CFUV 101.9 FM broadcasts from the Songhees and Wasanich territories, also known as Victoria, BC. You can listen to our music, spoken word, and multicultural programs anywhere, anytime at cfuv.ca.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio's Home Edition, recorded June 26th, 2021. Well, America's Democratic Party may not be the war party, but it certainly is not an agent of peace. The Biden war budget, or national security budget, was quietly announced late on Friday, May 28th, fully 4 months into his administration. The war spending leaves Trump's Republicans standing in the dust, setting new records for both peace and wartime military largesse. But even more worrying than the fantastical dollar amounts devoted to war and its preparation is where much of that money is earmarked to go, straight into next-gen nukes development. David Lindorf is a longtime Izzy Award-winning journalist, author, and co-producer of the documentary Film in Progress on Ted Hall, the American who may well have saved Russia and the world from nuclear conflagration. Dave's also the founder of the news website ThisCan'tBeHappening.net, where his latest piece, Building More Atomic Bomb Triggers is the Pits, Time to Stop Modernizing America's Nukes and to Start Negotiating Peace, appears. Dave Lindorf in the first half. And 74 or so years ago, our forebears brought forth an agreement with the Crown of England, wherein the entity now often known as Canada came into being. Just what is the state of that state now, 154 years later? Dimitri Lascaris is a Montreal-based activist, lawyer, journalist, and past Green Party of Canada leadership contender. Dimitri Lascaris and Wither Canada 2021 in the second half. But first, Dave Lindorf and the Biden administration getting the new nuclear arms race running. Welcome back to the program, Dave.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Dave. Now, before getting to Joe Newcomb's plans to light up the world, how's the Ted Hall film coming along?
It's really exciting how it's moving. We've hired the director who did the reenactments in the movie 1971. Did you see that? About the break-in at the Media Pennsylvania FBI office in 1971?
No, I missed it.
Oh, my God. If you haven't seen it, you got to see it. It is so good. That's where they discovered COINTELPRO. They raided the FBI office in the middle of the night and got all their files and never got caught. And then they went public a couple of years ago. And then this documentary was made. It's a bunch of professors and grad students did it. It was an incredible heist. They trained at lock picking professionally and stuff. It was like a 1 year preparation. It's fantastic. And the movie is amazing. 1971.
Does George Clooney know about this?
You mean to do a dramatization of the thing?
Yeah.
Well, this is such a dramatic documentary that I don't think it needs a drama. It's awesome. And our film's going to be awesome, too, because we're having reenactments of a lot of the major events in Ted and Joan's life. And the same director that did those, from 1971 with Verisimilitude is going to do them for us with, 1945 and 1950s and 1960s Verisimilitude.
Well, could you just give us, without being a spoiler, just a little brief idea of what the film's about and who Ted Hall was?
Yeah, Ted Hall was a teenager hired on his 18th birthday at Harvard as a junior physics major to go to work at Los Alamos because he was extraordinarily brilliant and was recommended for it. Ended up working on helping to rig up the implosion device for the plutonium bomb, which is very complicated and needed a lot of jerry-rigging. So he knew all the details, and he decided about 6 months in that this bomb was going to be they'd already defeated the Germans by that point, and he decided that this bomb, from what he was hearing, was really being designed to be used against the Russian Soviet Union, and that somebody had to do something to let the Russians get their own bomb or else. And he was also worried about the U.S. with a monopoly on the bomb anyway, for all the things it would do. So he did it. He found a way to locate a Russian intelligence officer, which was not easy, and he did it, went about it like an amateur, and finally it worked. And then after he made contact, they first really doubted that he had anything, but they realized when they saw the stuff he was offering them that it was the real deal. So he got taken on. And so for 2 years at Los Alamos, 44, 45, and through 46, actually, he was a spy for the Soviet Union and really helped them get their bomb before the U.S. would have done a preemptive attack with hundreds of bombs on Russia to prevent them from getting it.
Well, I say in the introduction, too, that what he did saved Russia from nuclear conflagration and maybe even the world, because if the Americans under Truman had carried out what they had planned or hoped to do, which was to drop 300-plus nuclear bombs on Russia, I don't think that at that time these guys even had a good notion of the radioactive fallout and what that would cause to the planet generally.
No, and they also would have used it in third world conflicts all over the place. So, he is absolutely right. The U.S. was perfectly willing to kill millions of people since World War II with conventional weapons. And if they'd had at their disposal a free hand to use nuclear weapons, they surely would have done that. So he really did, I think, help save the world, him and Klaus Fuchs. And he never got caught. And that is the real story, why he didn't get caught. And I'm just starting to get the pieces of that. And it's an amazing drama. The one thing the Russians did really successfully, besides getting the secret, was they totally siloed all their spies. So, when you caught one spy, you didn't catch all the others, because they separated all the people that were doing the courier work for each spy. So only the actual Russian intelligence agents knew who all the spies were.
And Hall, you mentioned, was working on the triggers, very complicated, but also complicated. And in your recent article, Building More Atomic Bomb Triggers is the Pit, Time to Stop Modernizing America's Nukes and to Start Negotiating Peace. That's at thiscan'thappening.net. You describe these pits because, maybe you can describe what they are, Dave, and why it's important and why you're writing about it now.
So the basic atomic bomb, the fission bomb, that was created in 1945, was made by either of U-235 or plutonium-239. And uranium-235 is very difficult to make, as the Iranians are proving, because you have to have a vast number of centrifuges, and you have to isolate out this tiny fraction of the uranium in a pure metal of uranium, after you've refined it out of the ore, and get this tiny fraction out that's 239 and get rid of all the rest, because the rest of it won't make a chain reaction and create a bomb. U-238, which is what almost all the uranium is radioactive, but it doesn't, and you can use it to some extent in a nuclear reactor if you have some 235, but you need pure 235 to get a explosion. So it's not a great way to make the bomb. It's simple because it's got an easy calculable critical mass. So you make that certain amount, cut it in half before you make it, and then you put the two halves in a cannon, one with a charge behind it and the other waiting at the other end with the flat side facing it. And then you fire off the cannon inside the bomb. It doesn't have to be a very long cannon. And the two pieces get rammed together at high velocity, and that causes the instant, as soon as their two faces get rammed together, their critical mass, and you get the explosion. And that was the Hiroshima bomb. The complicated bomb is the plutonium one, because plutonium has a lot of impurities in it and characteristics that make it not possible to predict when it hits criticality, right? You can come close, but you can't be absolutely sure when it's going to go. So you can imagine this makes it very hard to work with. And if you work at the low end of it, which is safer, because then it won't detonate before you want it to, it might not detonate when if you put two halves together like that. So what they came up with was they would make a ball of the stuff that was safely below like guaranteed criticality, and then that was called the pit would be wrapped in these so-called lenses, which were sort of hexagonal pieces coming to a point or almost a point, wrapped all the way around the I think it was 36 pieces that encased the pit. And then outside those, they would put explosive charges on each one of these lenses. And actually, I think below the lenses were tampers, they called them, which were metal pieces that would slam into the plutonium. So they were like layers of stuff, explosion, lens, tamper, and they'd fire off. The explosions all had to go off simultaneously, which was also a trick. And so when all those conventional explosions went off simultaneously, all these pieces would slam together into the plutonium and compress it really densely, and then you had a guaranteed explosion. So it was complicated. And the tests that Ted was working on were to make it so that when you measured the neutrons coming out of that burst of chain reaction, they had to be completely uniform in every direction, 360 degrees of the sphere, in order to get an explosion like you got at Nagasaki or the Trinity test. If you didn't get the 360, the chain reaction didn't really happen, and you got what was known as a fizzle. And we saw that happen with the Koreans. They had a couple of bombs that were called fizzles. They didn't really work. And so they were using plutonium, and they weren't succeeding at first, but they finally got it. So anyway, that's the pit. And over the years, you know, from the interesting thing is that from World War II, immediately after the war, they started making more atomic bombs, even though nobody else had it, and they didn't think the Russians would have it for 8 to 10 years. They started trying to build new ones, and they had two by the end of 1945. They had nine altogether by the end of 1946, because they were being made by hand. And in early 1947, Truman asked the Atomic Energy Commission, how many bombs do we have? And the guy said, kind of sheepishly, 12. And Truman said, what? That's all we've got? He was horrified. He said, we need to ramp up production. We need to industrialize production. And you might ask why, but at any rate, they figured out a way to speed it up. And they were also, of course, they had the Oak Ridge plant that was creating refined U-235 as fast as they could. So they were also making the atomic pits out of U-235. And by October of, July 1949, they had something like 220, I think. And by October, they had 250. And that, of course, in the interim between July and October, the Russians exploded their own plutonium bomb, which was a carbon copy, thanks to Ted, of the Nagasaki bomb, August 29th, 1949. And the significance of that is, which nobody seems to know, but it was written in a book by Michio Kaku and Daniel Axelrod, more about him later. In their book, written in 1987, they got a lot of national security documents, and it showed all these bombs that were being made and how many there were at every given moment. And what they were trying to do was, the Pentagon had told Truman, in response to a question from him, that they thought it would take 300 Nagasaki bombs on Russian cities and on Red Army bases to totally destroy the Soviet Union as an industrial power and prevent it from retaliating by overrunning Western Europe. So they were working hard to get that 300 bombs, and they hadn't gotten there yet. They also were working hard to build enough B-26 bombers, the only plane that the U.S. had that could carry the plutonium bomb and go any significant distance. And so they were trying to do that, and they hadn't done it by August, and they weren't going to be able to achieve it until around 1950. So basically, the plan to destroy Russia was called off, or at least deferred. And ever since then, the U.S. has been trying to achieve a situation of superiority in which they could count on destroying the Soviet Union before, or Russia before, it could get its own missiles launched, and that they could shoot down whatever got through. And they've never managed to, luckily, to achieve that. But as Daniel Ellsberg wrote in 2017 in the Doomsday Machine book, attacking first has always been U.S. nuclear strategy from day one, and still is. So all they tell us about how, you know, they're building to have a credible deterrent force to prevent an attack on the U.S. is complete BS. It's all about trying to achieve superiority so that we can strike first and not get counterattacked.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today to Dave Lindorf. Dave's a longtime Izzy Award-winning journalist, author, co-producer of the documentary film In Progress on TED Hall. Dave's also the founder of the web news site ThisCan'tBeHappening.net, where his latest piece, Building More Atomic Bomb Triggers Is the Pits, Time to Stop Modernizing America's Nukes and to Start Negotiating Peace, appears. Well, Dave, even though there's thousands of these pits in existence already, Joe Biden, in his military budget announcement, he calls, much as Truman did, for not as Truman did, the industrialization of fabrication of more of these pits, but the reindustrialization of fabrication of these pits. And these pits, you say, can even be they can be, quote, usable as atomic bombs on their own, like these little so-called theater nukes.
Yeah, you can make a 5-kiloton bomb with a pit. You know, you can, and that's pretty small. That's like a third of Hiroshima. So the point about the pits was that, you know, Obama called for a $1.3 trillion modernization program over 10 years of the U.S. nuclear arsenal, and one of the reasons given is that these pits gradually cease to work because the plutonium stays radioactive. People have told me, and I read in Ellsberg, because he spent a lot of time with nuclear weapons over his years at Rand. He said he got to go where the weapons are being stored in these underground bunkers, and he said when you go to the plutonium weapons, or the hydrogen bombs that have a plutonium core, you can put your hand on the weapon and it's warm on the outside because of the radioactivity inside. So the plutonium is gradually leaking out its radioactivity, and eventually it won't have criticality. So nobody really knows when that happens, and so they would like to test them, but they're not allowed to test them. So there's this concern that some of the American hydrogen bombs will be duds because of the used up plutonium in the pit. So the idea was they wanted to make more pits and replace the pits. You know, one could argue, well, don't do that because this is a way to do disarmament. Just let the pits wear down and eventually we'll have a bunch of duds on missiles and no one will dare to fire them because they won't know if they will work. That's a great way to disarm without ever having to say you're disarming. But, they want to make these pits. So Biden ordered Los Alamos, which can make pits, but hasn't made them in decades. And what's the other place? Oh, Savannah River operation can make them. Savannah River can theoretically make about 80 per year and with present facilities, and Los Alamos can make about 50. So there's 130 pits per year, and they'll probably expand that. So what they want to do is, you know, eventually not only replace all the pits in the 3,800 bombs that the United States is allowed to have under the Nuclear Arms Limitation Agreement, but also to make new, smaller, tactical nukes that require new pits. And so I said, you know, this is an outrageous thing to be doing. We should be reducing our bombs, not figuring out ways to make new and usable bombs. And, you know, we shouldn't be replacing the pits in the weapons we have. Let them fail.
Biden announced last month $753 billion for the national security budget, $38 billion, you report, going to pit effort. And you say in the article, Dave, this spending is more egregious, considering we're, quote, it's occurring in a time the U.S. is not actually fighting any wars, when it seems, if you look around, the U.S. is actually fighting wars on every front, just not in the traditional manner.
Well, I think it is a abuse of the English language to call what we're fighting wars. You know, we're fighting special op insurgencies in various countries, but a war is really when you have, like, significant fighting by two sides. You can't have, like, a war against people, I don't think. That's just an aggression and a genocide. But when you have two sides fighting, that's a war. And a lot of our things, we're not really fighting two sides. We're fighting, people we call terrorists, or we're overthrowing governments, or in Syria, it's not really the U.S. fighting a war against Syria. It's the U.S., like, undermining the Syrian government, I would say. And I can't find a place where I would say that the U.S. is currently engaged in a war. Even Afghanistan, it's the leftover of a war. There's only 2,500 soldiers there, and maybe, you know, twice that again in mercenaries who aren't always fighting. Well, I think they're mostly protecting poppy farms.
Well, we can call it the absence of peace, but anybody living in those cities in Syria that resemble nothing more than the Russian cities did during the long sieges during the Second War, just the bones of a fractured coral reef is what it looks like from above.
Yeah, but that's not the U.S. that's doing most of that bombing, and it's not even Russia that's doing most of that bombing. It's Syria that's doing the bombing, and they're protected, or they're attacking the people that the U.S. is supporting and things like that. So it's more complicated than the U.S. being involved in a war. That's my point.
Well, you're right that, most of the so-called aggression in the world today, especially when it comes to the American press describing China and Russia, is actually economic development, like the Belt and Road Initiative.
Yeah, that's what we call aggression. We call that aggression. That the pipeline for natural gas that Russia is installing under the Baltic to supply Germany is called aggression. I mean, that's so ludicrous.
Well, another,
it's hard to wrap my brain around it.
Well, another place that America has demonized is Iran. And right now, next week, the seventh round of the JCPOA talks in Vienna, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action about the denuclearization of Iran, are going on. And is it not ironic? Biden comes up with this nuclear announcement. Wouldn't this, I think, convince Iran that their only hope of salvation is to have a deterrent of their own?
Of course. That's why the U.S. doesn't invade Korea. They have the bomb. You know, that's not lost on the rest of the world that has to worry about America. If you get the bomb, you don't get invaded. If you don't have the bomb, you get invaded. So, we're teaching this lesson, get the bomb, right? It's common sense.
Well, and I guess finally, Dave, how dependent is this reindustrialization of pit production on the so-called atoms for peace, or the peaceful atomic power electricity generation plants, a whole new generation of which are being proposed as well?
They have facilities like in South Carolina to crank out the plutonium and to crank out the, you know, plutonium is a waste product of nuclear. Every nuclear reactor makes plutonium. So if you have nuclear power plants, you have plutonium, which the government happily says it'll take off your hands. And it's the only nuclear waste that the government will happily take off your hands. the rest of it. They're trying to figure out a way to store it, but right now they just tell the power plants, keep it on site, you know, because nobody wants it. But we'll take your plutonium. So, you know, they're happy to get it, but if they couldn't get it because nuclear power plants were all shut down, they would get it from the facility they have in South Carolina, which you can make a reactor to actually generate plutonium, and it's a much more efficient way to do it than if you're designing a power plant to make electricity. So they wouldn't be hard pressed to come up with the plutonium they need. And they also have facilities to make as much uranium-235 as they want, too.
Yeah, I think it's called Canada. Well, Dave's article is, again, it's building more atomic bomb triggers is the pits. Time to stop modernizing America's nukes and to start negotiating peace. You can find that at thiscan'tbehappening.net. Thanks a lot for coming on to tell us a little bit about this today, Dave. And do you have a release date, or is it too soon to say for the film?
Well, I can tell you it'll be out in the spring. We just interviewed today Daniel Axelrod, the co-author of that book to Win a Nuclear War, that tells all about these pits and the early days of trying to build enough bombs to destroy Russia preemptively. So he's in the can now. We have a couple more interviews to do, and in August we'll be filming the reenactments, and then it'll be time to edit it all together. We'll have everything else in the can.
And, have you come up with a title yet, Dave?
The working title is Joan and Ted, and the teenage spy who risked his life to save the world. But that's kind of long, so I don't know. We'll come up with something. I don't know how much time there is left, but the real story that's coming out now is Ted's brother, who is 11 years older, was actually in charge of, for 6 years, the U.S. ballistic missile development program in the 50s. And you wonder, how the hell did that happen? And, you know, because they knew Ted was a spy. And what we're finding out, and I'm getting the details now from FOIA, is that it looks like the Air Force, which had raised this guy to colonel and, you know, really loved him. He was, like, critical to the program. Brilliant rocket scientist. They basically shut down Hoover and didn't allow him to prosecute Ted. And this was during the Army hearings, the McCarthy Army hearings. I mean, if this had come out that Ted's brother was running the ballistic missile program, it would have vindicated everything that McCarthy was claiming, you know, that the military was infested with communists. Not that he was a communist. He wasn't at all, but he was found to be very loyal. But he really protected Ted. And so, you know, it's a very strange phenomenon to have one guy gives the Russian the bomb and the other guy's making the missiles too, because he didn't want, you know, he wanted the bomb to be banned, and his brother is building the missiles to deliver the bombs that Ted made to blow up the Russians. It's just an incredible story.
Stranger than fiction.
Yeah,
so I can't wait. I can't wait for the film, Dave. And again, and we'll talk again, I'm sure, when it comes out or before that time.
Okay, great.
Now I want everyone else to stick around because Dimitri Lascaris is coming right up. We're going to talk about the Green Party's own nuclear meltdown in Canada. That's right after the break.
Guerrilla Radio, 101.9 FM, CFUV.ca. Guerrilla Radio, 101.9 FM, CFUV.ca. Guerrilla Radio, 101.9 FM, CFUV.ca.
Supplies and books and sleeping bags and
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, 7 score and 14 years or so ago, our forebears brought forth an agreement with the Crown of England, wherein the entity now often known as Canada came into being. Just what is the state of that state now, 154 years later? Dimitri Lascaris is a Montreal-based activist, lawyer, journalist, and past Green Party of Canada leadership contender. Dimitri fell just short of securing the Greens' top spot in last year's leadership contest, ultimately taken by Annamie Paul. Welcome back to the program, Dimitri.
Thank you for having me, Chris. Always a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's always my great pleasure, of course. Now, Dimitri, this show goes to air on Canada Day, or Dominion Day to those of my vintage, or will it? If we're to believe the leader of the Tory Party, the enemies of Canada, Justin and his cancel culture friends, plan to cancel the fireworks, forgetting the Republican retread party's trolling. What do you, Dimitri, believe is an appropriate response to the recent revelations of mass graves under the residential schools in this country?
Well, I think we should do everything we can to fully ascertain the extent of the horror. And that means that the government should provide all technological, physical, and financial resources necessary to conduct the kinds of forensic examination that's only begun, so that we can determine how many mass graves, how many unmarked graves there are at the various sites of these terrible institutions, what's left of them around the country. I think that we should have already fully implemented by now, or at least to the greatest extent humanly possible, all of the recommendations of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and we should redouble our efforts to do that. My recollection recently, I was reading a review of where we stand in that regard, and my recollection is that we had implemented something in the range of 17 of over 100 recommendations. So we're not even close to having implemented half, let alone all of the recommendations of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. As for Canada Day, symbolic gestures matter, but not nearly as much as substantive gestures like fulfilling the recommendations of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Why not make, you know, in terms of a symbolic gesture, why not make this upcoming Canada Day a national day of mourning for the children who died in the residential schools and whose deaths were never fully accounted for, or some other gesture of that nature to fully recognize Canada's responsibility in this regard. But I think what really matters more, you know, I can't stress this enough, than symbolic gestures, is substantive implementation of all the recommendations of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Yeah, well, and Canada is already a signatory to the UNDRIP, or the United Nations Declarations on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, but we haven't really lived up to that. I mean, symbolic gestures is all we have made, or lip service, some would say, and I see that all the time, that the federal government is spending more money fighting Indigenous claims in courts.
They are, which I think, you know, really tells us where is rather revealing of the government's mentality towards Indigenous rights in this country. It has always been more about rhetoric than true reconciliation. So, for example, you know, we should have in this country the legal system should confer upon Indigenous communities an absolute right of veto over the land and resources within their sovereignty. What we currently have is a system which only requires government and private actors to consult in good faith with indigenous communities. That is something that they often do not even do. They do not even go that far. But if they are adjudged by the courts to have consulted in good faith with indigenous communities that are impacted by, for example, resource projects, then typically the courts will deem that to be sufficient, even if at the end of the day, following the consultation, the government decides to take steps that are not do not meet with the consent of the indigenous community being impacted by the resource project. What we should say to what we should have within our legal system is an absolute right of veto. So if the indigenous communities, after being fully consulted, say no, we do not consent, then the project would not proceed. Then whatever measure being proposed to exploit the land or resources of indigenous communities should simply not proceed. That's not what we have in this country. We should have stable, adequate funding for indigenous communities in this country. You know, something I'd proposed when I was running to be the leader of the Green Party of Canada, I feel strongly about, is that we should have annually a commitment to provide a fixed percentage of Canadian gross domestic product to indigenous communities around the country. We should provide ample and stable, predictable funding for things like healthcare systems in indigenous communities, educational systems, mental health, you know, the full array of social programs, social supports that are necessary in order to give indigenous peoples their full dignity and full sovereignty.
You're probably aware of what's going on here in on Vancouver Island with Ferry Creek and then the forestry debate of over first growth or old growth forests on the Patchidat territory, where the community itself, as we see in much of the country, this old colonial model is divided, with half of the community saying one thing and the other half the other, or various percentages of that. But are we just putting a fox in the hen house by saying, well, the First Nations should have the choice in the final analysis, when their decision-making processes are being manipulated?
Well, first, every Indigenous community should decide what consent means, how consent of the community is to be ascertained. It shouldn't be determined according to some colonial structure that has been imposed upon Indigenous communities by Canada's federal government. And secondly, I think it's fair to say that sometimes Indigenous communities or their representatives will consent to resource projects, not because they're deemed to be in the long-term best interests of the community, but because, you know, there's a certain level of desperation for sources of funding for social supports within the community. And if we were providing fixed, stable, and ample resources, economic resources to indigenous communities to meet the needs of their people, then they wouldn't feel the kind of compulsion that they sometimes feel to consent to resource projects in order to generate economic activity or funding for the community. We're putting them between a rock and a hard place in many instances. And so they're forced to consent to economic exploitation of their land and resources, to which they would not otherwise consent if they had alternative sources of funding for the needs of their communities.
Well, this economic desperation is endemic, and we see it, you know, across the country, where the reserve lands in many cases don't even have clean water. Here we are in this one of the wealthiest countries around, and yet we can't seem to manage to swing even clean water or safe power supplies for these communities.
Right, and when you're confronted by these kinds of choices, you're just simply struggling to meet the most basic needs of your community. Then sometimes you will, you know, you're going to be feel a compulsion to consent to economic activities on your land that you might not otherwise agree to, because you just need the money in order to meet the most basic needs of your community. So we shouldn't be putting Indigenous communities in this difficult situation where they have to choose between exploitative resource projects that are going to have negative long-term impacts on their land and their resources, or saying no and being left without access to the most basic services. That's a terrible choice to put them in, you know, and we're responsible for it as a country.
Well, as far as symbolic gestures, now the flags were flown at half staff after the initial discovery here in British Columbia of an unmarked grave, a children's grave. Also, I'm just reading today, the Canadian Museum of History has decided that it will cancel Canada Day activities in light of the second unmarked grave being discovered. I mentioned at the top that the Tories are trying to use this as a weapon against the government, trying to focus fringe voters, anger them, because they see, as I think a lot of people do, that there's an election in the wind. Do you think that we're looking at a fall election?
Oh, we may see something sooner than the fall. It wouldn't surprise me at all. You know, the one calculus, I think, which may enter into the Trudeau government's thinking right now, is that my party, the Green Party, is experiencing very considerable difficulties because of certain developments at the leadership level, which have, I think it's fair to say, hampered our ability to prepare fully for the upcoming election. And so that might be one factor militating in favor of a quick call of an election by the Trudeau government. But I think you look at the polls, you know, whatever may be happening within the Green Party, you know, the Trudeau government, I think, is feeling pretty good about its chances to secure a majority. Aaron O'Toole is not, you know, has not succeeded in broadening the appeal of the Conservative Party, the type of thing you're talking about, Chris, where, you know, there's sort of crass attempts to exploit sort of right-wing sentiment about Indigenous rights, nationalism within, you know, more right-leaning voters. I think that that is not going to succeed at the end of the day in broadening the appeal of the Conservative Party. In fact, recent polling shows that, if anything, Canadians have become much more aware, much more indignant about the historical injustices inflicted upon Indigenous peoples in this country. So an attempt to, you know, to curry political favor with Canadians by invoking the nationalism card, I don't think that's going to be successful. And I think that this Trudeau, you know, Liberals are sophisticated enough to understand that. And at the end of the day, they have plenty of reason to call an election sooner rather than later. So I think by the fall at the latest, and we may see something sooner than that.
Yeah, well, the Liberals might be, but I don't see that O'Toole is it. And more than nationalism, it seems like blowing dog whistles to appeal to those that have racist inclinations, the extreme right. And we've seen there's a trick that maybe Donald Trump might pull. I'm not really sure if the current confusion within the Green Party of Canada is much of a decision. I don't really see that they're very much of a threat. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today to Dimitri Lascaris. Dimitri's a Montreal-based activist, lawyer, journalist, and past Green Party of Canada leadership contender. Dimitri fell just short of securing the Greens' top spot in last year's leadership contest. That was ultimately won, of course, by Annamie Paul. I'm being a little cheeky, Dimitri. You said that the Green Party was your party. Do you still consider yourself, do you still consider that to be the case?
I certainly am, a member of the Green Party. I continue to be committed to the Green Party. I think, you know, the core values of the Green Party are those that are most closely aligned with my own amongst the various political parties that have representation in Parliament. So the answer is yes. But I will, you know, I confess I'm very concerned about what is going on within the Green Party of Canada. And if we continue down the path we're currently on, we're not going to be able to have a significant impact, a significant positive impact on the Canadian political scene. So, yes, I remain a member of the Green Party. I remain committed to the Green Party, but I'm deeply concerned about where the party is heading.
Well, I appreciate you're in a delicate position because you there was a closely fought leadership campaign that you came out on the lower side of. Right now, though, the person who did win that leadership contest is mired in controversy, and I appreciate that you can't speak against her without being seen as taking advantage of a weakened position, perhaps. But I'll just say for our listeners who aren't aware that even though it took 8 ballots before that decision of the leadership was arrived at, you were not offered a position, a high position within the party. That's unusual to me, and that would suggest that the party itself doesn't have a inclination to reach out and build a big tent, because it is a party with very disparate support.
Yeah, so, well, I think the process... The process which the current leader, Annamie Paul, adopted for putting together a shadow cabinet was to invite people to apply for the position, which departed from prior practice where the leader extended invitations. And apparently there have been, you know, quite significant rigorous vetting of the applicants for positions to shadow cabinet. Candidly, I did not apply for a position to shadow cabinet. I wasn't encouraged to apply, nor did I apply. And I don't think that that is unique to me, based on what I've heard and from other leadership candidates. You know, I'm not aware of any of them having been encouraged to apply to shadow cabinet. I don't know what the leader's intentions are with respect to being a deputy leader. I wasn't approached about that. I wasn't encouraged to run as a candidate, and I'm in fact not going to run as a candidate in the upcoming election. I've not sought the nomination in any riding because of various very significant concerns I have with what's happening at the leadership level. So I don't want to, you know, I don't think it would be fair to say that that my declining to be, my not entering the shadow cabinet or running as a candidate are due entirely to the failure on the part of the leader to encourage my involvement. I didn't candidly seek out a nomination in any riding, nor did I seek a position in shadow cabinet. But the reasons for that are, frankly, that I'm concerned about what's happening at the leadership level, and particularly you know, the leader's position with respect to recent comments that our senior advisor made about me and about two of our MPs, one of whom has now left and gone over to the Liberal Party, after we took a stand publicly in relation to current acts of violence being perpetrated by the Israeli government against Palestinians. We took positions which were consistent with party policy on this subject after the party issued a statement quoting the leader, which did not reflect party policy. And so after we, you know, effectively defended party policy through our public commentary, we were met with harsh condemnation by her now former senior advisor, and the leader did not, for some weeks, repudiate what he had said about us. And this precipitated the departure of, you know, a wonderful young MP, Jenica Atwin, the youngest member of our caucus, the only member of our caucus to have secured a riding outside of British Columbia. And the leader since then has not taken responsibility for Jenica's departure, for what happened. And in fact, has argued, implausibly, I might say, that Jenica's departure was unrelated to the attacks on her, Paul Manley, and me by the former senior advisor of the leader. So this is a situation which is causing tremendous dissent within the party. There have been calls for the leader's resignation or removal. I think that the key to resolving this is for the leader, and I've said this publicly, Chris, this is not the first time I've said this, is for the leader to take responsibility for Jenica's departure, acknowledge her mistakes in this regard, and completely repudiate what her former senior advisor said, and stand up for the party's member-approved policy on Israel-Palestine. If she does take those steps, and I very much hope that she does, as in the very near future, then we can begin the process of healing these divisions that have developed since the leadership contest. But if she does not refuse, if she does not take responsibility for these things, I don't think we're going to be able to heal these divisions. And this is going to have a very negative impact on our performance in the upcoming election. For me personally, I mean, this is fundamentally why I did not feel comfortable seeking a nomination in any riding, because I'm very concerned about the leader's refusal to take responsibility for what's happened.
Well, Jenica Atwin, she, the New Brunswick MP, crossed the floor to the Liberals, and as a part of the process, I guess I'll put it, she vouchsafed her support for the State of Israel. So it seems that if she left because of the failure of the Green Party to live up to its own mandate on Palestine, a hard-fought mandate that was adopted by the party over much controversy that involved Elizabeth May, and she turned around and sort of just, it seems, changed her position once she joined the Liberals. Am I being unfair in saying that?
Well, yeah, I think it's important to understand there are two distinct issues when it comes to Jenica's departure of the Liberal Party, from our caucus and her crossing the aisles of the Liberal Party. The first one is, why did Jenica leave? And the second one is, did she make the right choice in going to the Liberals? Okay, so one could quite logically say she left for perfectly legitimate reasons, but she made the wrong decision in terms of where to go. And that, in fact, is what I believe to be the case. I didn't want Jenica to leave the caucus, but I certainly understand why somebody who has been attacked, accused falsely of anti-Semitism by the leader's senior advisor, and is not defended in any way, shape, or form by the leader over a period of weeks following the attack, why that person would feel unwelcome and feel that her position has been completely compromised within the caucus, and that she needs to pursue another avenue politically. So that's a decision which I completely understand. I wish Jenica hadn't made that decision, but it's an understandable one in the circumstances. Now, she could have stood it. She could have, you know, become an independent, or perhaps she could have gone to the NDP if the NDP had been willing to take her, because the NDP's platform is significantly more aligned with the Green Party platform than the Liberal Party platform. But instead, she went to a party which inevitably was going to silence her on a range of issues, not just on Israel-Palestine, but with respect, for example, to her opposition to new fossil fuels infrastructure, her opposition to fracking. So it was a terrible choice, frankly. I have a lot of respect for Jenica, and I still cling to the hope that one day she'll return to the Green Party. But going to the Liberals was definitely the wrong move. And it was entirely predictable that the, you know, Liberal leadership would immediately apply intense pressure to get Jenica to revoke her quite appropriate acknowledgement that Israel is an apartheid state. That was entirely predictable. And I think that as a result of that, some people have formed some skepticism about Jenica's claim that her departure was tied to the attack from Noah Zatzman, the former senior advisor of the leader. But I think it's entirely plausible and believable that that is was at least a major factor in Jenica's thinking. She just happened to make the wrong decision in terms of where to go.
Maybe the liberals were the only ones that offered her the option.
It seems to have been the case. My understanding about the NDP, by the way, is that they have a policy of not accepting MPs from other parties who want to cross the aisle to their party. So she would have been essentially obliged to, I believe how it would have worked, is she would have been obliged to sit as an independent until the election. Then she would have been obliged to seek the NDP nomination in her riding. But whatever the process may have been, it seems quite clear that the NDP did not approach her, did not indicate a willingness to her to go over to their party. The Liberals did do that. As I say, I don't think that that is a justification for Jenica having gone to the Liberals, because at the end of the day, it would have required and did in fact require her to compromise on her core values. That's just the nature of the Liberal Party. But that doesn't exonerate the leader for putting Jenica in a position where she felt that she was no longer viable or had no longer in a viable position within the Green Party caucus.
Well, I imagine if the Liberals hadn't been in a minority position that they are now, that offer would likely not have been an option anyhow. Dimitri, we're fast running out of time, but I don't want to leave without marking that today, June 26th, as we record this, is the 11-year anniversary of the Toronto G20. And it's something that Paul Jay, and I know you used to work with the Real News Network, Paul Jay's site. He, in a recent piece, he says what happened at the G20, a model for training police across North America in techniques in repression. And he called it the greatest violation of civil rights in Canadian history. I would say the Japanese and the First Nations might argue that. What's your take on this anniversary and the G20 and what Canada looks like 11 years after that happened?
I think if anything, we've moved in the wrong direction since then. I think our police have become increasingly militarized. They continue to use repressive tactics at peaceful protests. They continue to show disregard, even contempt in some circumstances, for the civil liberties of Canadians. I don't think we've learned the lessons of the G20 at all. And if anything, I think that our government, both federally and provincially, governments in this country are showing an increasing level of discomfort with popular dissent, peaceful popular dissent. And I'm very concerned about that, Chris. You know, as the fundamental crises that confront us, including the climate crisis, continue to go unaddressed, as the consequences of that become more and more severe, there will be naturally, inevitably, more intense and broad-based expressions of dissent from the populace, because of these government failures. And I think the government at a certain level understands that, and rather than deal with the underlying causes of the increasing dissent that we're seeing amongst civil society, and addressing the concerns, what it is doing is it's dealing with the symptoms in an increasingly militaristic and forceful way. And where this all ends is something of great concern to me, and it ought to be to all Canadians. The trends in this country that we see in terms of policing, they're not confined to Canada either. I mean, we're seeing this throughout the West. We see it in France. We see it in the United States. We see it in Britain. Rather than deal with the underlying causes of popular unrest, governments are simply trying to suppress popular expressions of opposition to failures of our governments to deal with the pressing issues of our time. I think it's important that we recall what happened during the G20. We be cognizant of the fact that we have not learned the lessons of the G20. If anything, we've gone in the opposite direction, and policing and the quality of policing has declined, if anything, since that time.
Well, and finally, Dimitri, the election coming up, whether it's August or September or maybe October on the outside, I would guess myself, would you consider running as an independent? I know that the eco-socialists are aren't, I imagine the eco-socialists aren't ready to mount a campaign, or are they? Would you run in one way or the other?
I thought about that, but that's running as an independent is something that is challenging in the best of circumstances, Chris. And if you're going to do that, it's something you need to plan well in advance. And you know, up until very recently, that was something that was not even in my contemplation. The problems that I'm discussing.
How about taking over for Annamie Paul if she resigns?
Well, you know, that it wouldn't. First of all, she hasn't resigned. The job isn't available. But if the job were to become available, you know, honestly, what I would do at that point in time, I couldn't simply be appointed to the position. The new leader, I mean, there would be an interim leader appointed by the federal council, but then there would within a short period of time, there would be a leadership contest. And again, there would be a broad array of candidates from whom the members could choose. And, you know, I would have the option at that stage and throwing my hat in the ring and presenting my candidacy in hopes that the party's members would confer that privilege upon me. Whether I would do that or not, Chris, I mean, I think it would really depend, on who else is in the race. Because to be perfectly candid with you, I do not have a burning desire, and I never had a burning desire to be a politician. I entered politics because I looked across the political landscape in this country, and I could not see anybody who was serious about advancing an eco-socialist agenda, who had really put forward a thoughtful eco-socialist agenda and was genuinely determined to fight to the bitter end for the implementation of that agenda. Now, if somebody came forward, you know, whenever one day there will be a leadership contest in our party again, whether it happens next year, 5 years, whenever, if I look at the candidates who are standing and there is one or more who fit that bill, who, you know, are true eco-socialists and who are committed, you know, with every fiber of their being to advance an eco-socialist vision, not just within the Green Party, but for our country, I would happily stand aside and support that candidate and not assume the burdens of leadership, because they are considerable. To be fair to anybody who takes on the reins of leadership of a political party, the burdens are considerable. And so I love doing what I do. I'm an activist. I'm a journalist. I continue to practice law, but I do only cases that mean a great deal to me. And I don't have a burning desire to do something else. So that I just have to see what the lay of the land is if and when that opportunity arises.
Well, I agree. I don't see much, and yours was one of the more exciting campaigns that I can recall. Alec Mukherjee was the chair of the Toronto Police Services Board at the time of the G20. Paul Jay's theanalysis.news is where he does interviews commemorating that horrible day way back when. Thanks a lot, Dimitri, for coming on again. It's always a joy to talk to you, and thanks to Dave Lindorf and all the good folks to keep the wheels spinning up here week in and week out. That's all I've got for this time, but I will see you the next. Thanks again, Dimitri.
Thank you, Chris. Take care.
CFUV.uvic.ca.